Last week we looked at Dharmashastras, those texts that basically talk about the social sort of implications of the Vedic ritual worldview. If you follow the Vedic rituals, how would you then live in society, and how can your social life and your interactions with other people, whether that's in marriage or society more broadly, how can that contribute to the principle of the idea of sacrifice that we've seen that contributes to the dhritta, to the order of the world. And so the key concept there, as we've seen, is dharma. And really, in the dharma shastras already, but particularly in later texts, dharma kind of gradually comes to replace the notion of dhritta. There's a handout there. She had three pages. And so dharma gradually comes to replace the notion of dhritta, where dharma comes to be seen, literally dharma comes from the root, from dhrit, to uphold, to sustain. It comes to be seen as that which sustains there's a handout there. And so dharma becomes the more important concept. Dharma has sort of goes back to the Rig Veda, the term occurs there. In the sense that, in sort of a similar sense that you get it in later texts like the Dharma Shastras. But this becomes really the more important concept. And also the notion of, with Ritta, as we've seen, the emphasis is really on the world as a whole, on the natural world as well. With Dharma, the focus, as we've seen last week, becomes more and more on this world, on sort of the world we inhabit, and specifically the sort of society. And a lot of texts, Dharma Shastras, but also other texts will emphasize that the one of the main things that needs to be upheld is social, sort of the social structure and the stability of society. And that's where we've seen the notion of Varnashrama comes in, that each person has a particular Varna, a particular class in society, as well as a particular Ashrama, a particular sort of stage of life. And you have to act in accordance with that in order to sort of lead to the sort of in order to sustain the social order. Deviating from that is frowned upon. Now, in the Dharma Shastras themselves, already you get debates about what determines dharma, and so is it if I'm born as in a Brahmin family, does that make me a Brahmin? The Dharma Shastras are kind of a little ambiguous about that. Generally, the assumption is yes, it is by birth, it is through birth that you become that, but you may not live up to your birth, and in that case, society will have to deal with you differently. So a Brahmin who embodies the principles of a Brahmin should be treated differently from a person who happens to be born in a Brahmin family, but actually doesn't embody the values of a Brahmin. Those sort of questions are questions that will come up in the text that we'll be looking at in this session. Which are the Mahabharata in particular, but also to some extent the Ramayana. But what you get in the Dharma Shastras, it's often portrayed as sort of a black on white thing, and it's not quite like that, as we've seen briefly last week, where you have different Dharma Shastras disagreeing on certain, you know, what needs to be done in certain situations. And even one Dharma Shastra might present a variety of options. And as we've seen, it's the Dharma Shastras themselves state that it's the community of Brahmins in your own community that will have to determine what needs to be applied. If they disagree as well, you go with whatever sort of, you know, feels right to do. Now, the text we'll be looking at this today and this week, the Mahabharata and Ramayana, and particularly the Mahabharata, make all this a lot more complex. Both these texts are, in some sense, dharma texts, in that they're both concerned with dharma, as understood by the Dharma Shastras. But they both make this a little more complicated than it is in the Dharma Shastras, and they problematize dharma. And in very different ways, Now, these two texts, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, they're undoubtedly the most popular text in the history of Hinduism and in India today. A.K. Ramanujan, who was a great scholar of literature, of Indian literature, teaching in Chicago, he famously said that in India, no one ever hears the Ramayana for the first time. And the same could be said for the Mahabharata, that these stories, the stories that are told in these texts, permeate the entire culture to such an extent that you can never encounter it for the first time. It's just you're already part of it as you grow up in that. Both of these texts, unlike the other texts that we've been looking at, are both narrative texts. They tell a story, and it's through the story that they're attempting to teach something about dharma. And so that kind of sets them quite apart from the Dharma Shastras themselves, where it's more kind of rules that and guidelines that are set down that you're enjoined to follow. Here, the teaching occurs through narrative. You get a story that is told, and in the case of the Ramayana, the story itself really is the message. In the case of the Mahabharata, you'll get a lot of very lengthy expositions on dharma and on other religious topics, woven into the narrative itself. Now, both of these texts are often called itihasa, which is generally translated as histories. The Sanskrit, for those of you who know Sanskrit, iti. Thus indeed it was. It's just their histories. They tell the past of what happened, they tell these narratives of kings, royal lineages, and because of that, the dharma they're primarily concerned with is the dharma of kshatriyas, which we've seen last week is the ruling class, or the warriors. It's through a reflection on kshatriya dharma, on the dharma of kshatriyas, that you get sort of a broader reflection on dharma more generally. But often it focuses very strongly on the kshatriya dharmas. Now, the other thing that those two texts and those two stories have in common is that they're two stories that involve avatars. An avatar literally is a descent. It's a God who descends on earth and roams, lives like a human being here on earth, in this case as a human being, and performs acts that are meant to set an example or teach something to mankind. And this is important here for us because with those avatars that come into the story, you get a new dimension that we haven't seen yet in the texts that come before. And that is a focus on a particular deity who's considered to be the supreme deity, who's identified with the Brahman of the Upanishads. So it's the deity from whom this whole world comes, by whom this world is maintained and into whom this world is sort of reabsorbed at the end. In both these texts, in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, the deity that is worshipped is Vishnu. Their derivation of Vishnu would be Vaishnava. So they're Vaishnava texts. They're texts that deal with the worship of Vishnu. And now Vishnu, as I've mentioned a couple of weeks back, is a deity that occurs already in the Rig Veda. He's not a particularly prominent deity in terms of the number of hymns that are devoted to him. Of 1,028, there's about six that are devoted to Vishnu. So it's a small percentage. But we see him kind of rising to prominence already in the Brahmanas. And a couple of the Upanishads single him out as identify him with Brahman. But he becomes particularly prominent in both these texts, and particularly the Mahabharata, where the focus is really on him. Vishnu is the other great deity of classical Hinduism that you have is Shiva, and Shiva has a position in the Vedic texts as well, in the form of Rudra, and Rudra is a deity that's generally identified with Shiva, or in some cases seen as a sort of an emanation of Shiva, or a form of Shiva, a form that Shiva assumes. Like Vishnu, Rudra is not a particularly prominent deity in the texts, in the Rig Veda. There's about the same number of hymns devoted to him, but there's something very important about the way the Rig Veda, and then particularly the way the Brahmanas think about these two deities, that shows why it is Vishnu that becomes particularly prominent in the Mahabharata and in the Ramayana. Shiva, or Rudra, as he's called in the Rig Veda, Rudra is a deity that is really an outsider to the Vedic pantheon, in the sense that offerings that are made to Rudra will always be performed outside the sacrificial enclosure, and the hymns to Rudra in the Rig Veda have a very ambiguous character. On the one hand, Rudra is praised as being powerful, as being kind and benevolent, and often that's sort of how the hymns start, and then sort of halfway through the hymns shifts, and it's please protect us from yourself. And Rudra is seen as this wild deity who is easily angered, and in his anger can sort of kill your family and kill your cattle and riddle you with disease and so on. And so he kind of has that very ambiguous character in the Rig Veda, where he's honored and worshipped and praised. He's particularly invoked in healing rituals, but on the other hand, he's also strongly feared. It's sort of a deity that you don't want to come too close to. You offer respect, you make offerings and so on, but you do it from a distance. Vishnu, on the other hand, in the Rig Veda, is very closely allied with Indra, who, as we've seen, is the main deity that's worshipped in the Vedic text in the Rig Veda. And he is always portrayed as a very benevolent deity, a very kind and gracious god, who is very powerful, but will never use his power to lead to your harm. And he's particularly invoked often in the context of yajna, in the context of sacrifice. He is a deity who is kind to those who perform yajnas, to those who perform sacrifices, and those who perform sacrifices attain his abode. One passage in the Rig Veda states. This sort of link with yajna, with sacrifice, becomes particularly prominent in the Brahmana texts. And in the Brahmana texts, a phrase that often occurs is yajna vai Vishnu, that Vishnu indeed is yajna, Vishnu indeed is the sacrifice. And this is a phrase that recurs in these Brahmana texts, these supplementary texts to the four Vedas, where Vishnu is repeatedly identified with the sacrificial performance itself. He comes to embody the act of sacrifice himself. And it's therefore no surprise that already in some of the sort of later Upanishads and some of the more openly theistic Upanishads, but then particularly in later texts, Vishnu becomes identified with Purusha, or Purusha becomes identified with Vishnu. If you remember the Purusha Sukta, which describes how the whole world arises from the sacrifice of Purusha, and at the end of the hymn it says that Purusha is indeed sacrifice himself. Already in some of the Upanishads, in the later Upanishads, that identification is made. And so it's Vishnu is really kind of is seen as an insider to the Vedic ritual world. He's part of that. He's at the very center of that, whereas Rudra or Shiva is kind of on the fringes of that, on the border, the periphery of that. And this is how this sort of these very different positions of these two gods in Vedic texts explains, or kind of is reflected at least in the way the two traditions develop, the traditions that center on Vishnu, the Vaishnava traditions, and the Shaiva traditions that center on Shiva. The Shaiva traditions, in most cases, see themselves as outsiders to the Vedic tradition. They say we kind of, in the broadest sense, we belong to the Vedic tradition, but the Vedic tradition is really sort of nothing to be, you know, not something that you should take too seriously. It's very preliminary. It's very basic understanding of religious or spiritual life, and it's kind of you have to rise above that, and therefore rise above the injunctions of the Vedas, including issues of dharma, as a lot of Shaiva texts would say. The Vaishnava traditions, on the other hand, see themselves as privileged insiders. They say we belong to the Vedic tradition, but those Vedic ritualists who perform their rituals to go to heaven and to sustain dritta and so on, they just haven't realized the real point of these rituals. The real point of these rituals is the worship of Vishnu. And so they're privileged insiders in the sense that they see themselves as part of that tradition, but have a more privileged understanding of the principle behind it. And so it's here in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana that they're both narratives about Vishnu in his avatars, in his descents in this world. The Ramayana being the narrative of Rama, and the Mahabharata being the narrative of Krishna. With these texts, as I mentioned, we move into narrative, and particularly I'll say a bit more about the Ramayana in a moment, but the Ramayana is pretty much straightforward, sort of a very straightforward narrative. The Mahabharata is a lot more complex. And the Mahabharata, as well as other narrative texts that we'll talk about in 2 weeks, the Puranas, they position themselves in a particular way in regards to the Vedic texts, and in that they both see themselves as comprising the fifth Veda. So you have the four Veda, Rigsama, Yajur, Atharva, and the Mahabharata, in the beginning of the Mahabharata, and as well as a lot of Puranas, say that, well, we are the fifth Veda. We're on an equal level with the Vedic texts, and we sort of just elaborate on what's there in the Vedic text. Now, if you remember what we talked about earlier, you know, we have the distinction between Shruti and Smriti, the Shruti texts being those texts that are unauthored, that are considered to be eternal or emanating from Brahman, as it's said in the Upanishads. The Smriti texts being those texts written by specific individuals, at a particular time, at a particular place. And as we've seen, the Smriti texts are traditionally seen to be dependent for their authority on the Shruti text. And so the Smriti text cannot teach anything that's not contained in the Shruti text, but merely elaborate on that. And we've seen this very clearly in sort of the first Smriti text we looked at, which were those ritual manuals that tell you how to perform the rituals that the Vedic text, the Shruti text, talk about. They're clearly, their authority is purely derivative, and that they just explain how you should do the things that are talked about in those texts, and constantly cite the Shruti text in order to make their claim. The Dharmashastras are often they are considered Smriti as well, and are actually very often sort of take, if you see sort of a list of Smriti and Puranas and so on, Smriti there means Dharmashastra. They too merely elaborate on, you know, sort of what you need to do socially if you take the Shruti text seriously. And Ramayana and Mahabharata, as I said, they're called the Itihasa. Sometimes they're lumped in together with Smriti in its broadest sense as well. There, the relationship becomes a bit more complicated, that they see themselves as the fifth Veda, which means they say, okay, we're part of this Vedic tradition, we're on an equal level with that Vedic tradition, we are the fifth Veda, which has a different status from the other four Vedas. Whereas the other four Vedas, as we've seen, you need to be a twice born, you need to be a Brahmana, Kshatriya, or a Vaishya, who has to then be initiated into the study of the Veda, by which you become twice born, in order to be able to study it. Women are excluded from it, as we saw last week, as well as Shudras, the laborers, they're also excluded from study of the Veda. The Mahabharata and the Puranas claim that we are the fifth Veda, and this is the Veda that's accessible to anyone. The women can read this, Shudras can read this, often Brahma Bandhus, relatives of Brahmins, those who were born in Brahmin families but don't have the characteristics of a Brahmin, they can study this as well. This is open to anyone. And we present the teachings of the four Vedas, but in a much more accessible manner, in a much more appealing manner, and indeed in a much more comprehensive manner. And this notion of the fifth Veda, I gave you two passages on the handout that we've seen before in previous weeks. The first is from the Brihadaranyaka, the second from the Chandogya Upanishad. And both those passages, if you look at the Brihadaranyaka passage, as clouds billow from a fire lit with damp fuel, so indeed this immense being has exhaled all this, the Rig, the Yajur, the Sama, the Atharvaveda, the histories, the Itihasas, the ancient tales, the Puranas, these texts that we'll talk about in 2 weeks, and then you get a whole bunch of other things as well. And if you look at the Chandogya, you have Narada who comes to Sanat Kumar and says, I've studied everything there is to know, but I still don't know who I am. But there he lists, this is the third line down from the first column, I've studied the Rig Veda as also the Yajur Veda and the Sama and the Atharvana as the fourth, the corpus of histories, that's Itihasa again, and ancient tales, that's Purana, as the fifth among the Vedas, as the fifth Veda amongst the Vedas. And then you get a whole bunch of other ones. This passage of the Chandogya is often cited by later authors who argue that the Mahabharata and the Puranas, the Itihasa and the Purana should be understood to be the fifth Veda. Some commentators on those passages argue that, and this is both academic, sort of contemporary scholars, as well as traditional commentators, sometimes argue that the Itihasa and Purana that is referred to here cannot be taken to be these texts, but would refer to just narrative portions of Brahmana texts and Aranyakas, particularly because the first passage states, the Brihadaranyaka, that all this is exhaled from Brahman, which would make them all unaltered and eternal and so on, whereas the Mahabharata, as we will see in a moment, is in the Ramayana are seen traditionally to be written by particular sages. That's sort of a debate that's going on, particularly in the 14th century onwards, about the interpretation of those passages. But this is kind of where they're often referring to. But below that, you have two passages from the Mahabharata. This is from the very beginning, from the first book of the Mahabharata. That sort of states the same thing. And it's in those two passages, and we'll just look at the first one, that you see the Mahabharata is kind of saying, okay, I'm part of the Vedas. I'm the fifth Veda of the Vedas. But at the same time, I'm above them. I offer more than is what is found there. And so the first passage there, it's the end of the very first chapter of the Mahabharata. By the aid of history, by the aid of the Itihasa, and the Puranas, the Veda may be expanded. But the Veda is afraid of one of little information, lest he should hurt it. The translation is about 100 years old, so it's a little archaic at times. I apologize for that. The learned man who recites to others this Veda of Vyasa reaps advantage. It may without doubt destroy even the sin of killing the embryo and the like. The man who with reverence daily listens to the sacred work acquires long life and renown and ascends to heaven. In former days, having placed the four Vedas on one side and the Bharata on the other, these were weighed in the balance by the celestials assembled for that purpose. So in the past, the gods took the Vedas and the Mahabharata, put them on scales to sort of see which one is weightier, which one is more important. And as the latter, as the Bharata, weighed heavier than the four Vedas with their mysteries, from that period it has been called in the world the Mahabharata, the Great Bharata. Being esteemed superior both in substance and gravity of import, it is denominated Mahabharata on account of such substance and gravity of import. He that knows its meaning is saved from all sins. And so the Mahabharata is saying, you know, I'm part of this tradition, but really I have more. This is a heavier text. There's more to be found in here than is to be found in the others. And the second passage, which is the end of the second chapter of the Mahabharata, kind of continues on that, but takes this one step further. And just to briefly a few passages from that. He who knows the four Vedas with all the Angas, with all the supplementary texts, as well as the Upanishads, but does not know this Itihasa, this Mahabharata, cannot be regarded as wise. Vyasa, who is traditionally seen as the author of the Mahabharata, of immeasurable intelligence, has spoken of the Mahabharata as a treatise on Artha and Dharma and on Kama. These are the three sort of aims of life, Artha being wealth, Dharma being Dharma, and Kama being pleasure. Those who have listened to this history can never bear to listen to others, as indeed they who have listened to the sweet voice of the male cuckoo can never hear the dissonance of the crow's cawing. As the formation of the three worlds proceeds from the five elements, so do the inspirations of all the poets proceed from this excellent composition. As the four kinds of creatures, those born from the wombs, from water, from heat, and from seeds, are dependent on space for their existence, so the Puranas, the other text, the other sort of part of the fifth Veda, depend on this Mahabharata. So it's not even in the fifth Veda there's a hierarchy, the Mahabharata is higher. As all the senses depend for their exercise upon the various modifications of the mind, so do all ritual actions and moral qualities depend upon this treatise. There is not a story current in the world that does not depend on this history, even as body upon the food it takes. All poets cherish the Bharata, even as servants' desires of preferment always attend upon masters of good lineage. There's a very strong claim the Mahabharata is making here. It's saying not just that everything that is, whatever is found in the other texts, if you know all the Vedas, if you know all the Upanishads, and you do not know the Mahabharata, you're ignorant. You have not understood the full, everything that there is to know. All the other texts depend on this text, and all texts that will be produced later on, I forget if it's in this passage, anyway, in this chapter it's claimed that whatever poets will write after this will be dependent on, will sort of find its origins in this text. And so here we start to see that very complex relationship between these two. In theory, the Mahabharata is saying, yes, I'm dependent on the Shruti for my authority, in the sense that I'm one of the fifth Vedas, so I'm sort of, you know, places itself in this tradition. But then at the same time, it's saying, well, I give more than what you find in those texts. And not just I give more, but I'm actually easier to read. I'm more enjoyable to read. You don't have to go through the rigors of Vedic study, as we've seen, memorizing the text backward and forward, as they do. You can just read a story, and in that story you will get everything that there is to know. So read me, don't forget about the Vedas. The Mahabharata, at the very beginning and at the very end, there's a verse that says that whatever is to be found elsewhere is found in this text. Whatever is found elsewhere is found here. Whatever is not found here is not found anywhere else. It's a very strong claim it makes, and we'll see the Mahabharata is very encyclopedic in nature. It's an enormous text. It's 80,000 verses long or so. Each translation is it's about this long and sort of several volumes. It's a massive text that is just basically covers pretty much everything you can think of, and the claim that whatever is not found here is not found elsewhere, there's something to be said for it. There's other aspects of Hinduism that are not talked about here, particularly goddess worship, for example, is not discussed in the Mahabharata at great length. But pretty much everything is covered there in some form or another. So that's kind of how these texts see themselves, or the Mahabharata sees itself in relation to the Vedic tradition. The Ramayana doesn't make such bold claims, as we'll see in a moment. It's a story, and the teaching is in its story, and that's pretty much it. Now, we've seen the Vaishnava character of these texts, the importance of the avatar, and it's in the importance of the avatar of Rama and Krishna that we see these that we can see these texts as dealing with dharma. Both those texts see the importance of the avatar as coming down to earth to teach mankind about dharma, to establish what it means to live a dharmic life. And you get this articulated, particularly in the Mahabharata. You have a very famous passage at the bottom of the page there, the first page, and then a longer passage from the Mahabharata. The first one is from the Bhagavad Gita, and we'll have a whole session on the Bhagavad Gita next week. But this, the Bhagavad Gita, is a part of the Mahabharata. It's a section, 18 chapters of the Mahabharata that have sort of become exerted and sort of are passed on as a separate text, but it's really a part of the narrative. And this is Krishna speaking, where he says, whenever there is a decline in dharma, whenever dharma decreases, O Bharata, this is Arjuna he's talking to, and whenever there is an increase in adharma, then I manifest myself for the protection of the righteous and for the destruction of the wrongdoers and for the purpose of establishing dharma. I appear age after age. And so the whole purpose of the avatar is to descend, to establish dharma, and to as he says here, to destroy the wrongdoers, those who pursue adharma, and those who kind of lead people astray by performing adharma. And this is in both texts seen to be particularly the kshatriyas, the ruling class, the warriors, the kings, who set the bad example. And you get this, we won't have time to read through it, but the passage from the first book of the Mahabharata that you have on the next page kind of makes that very clear, that Krishna descends in order to deal with those who do not follow dharma, and the kings that do not follow dharma. And the same is there in the Ramayana. There's one other element that comes in here that we haven't seen in earlier texts, or we haven't talked about in the context of earlier texts, and that is that Vishnu is seen. Actually, that's just at the beginning of this Mahabharata passage on the second page. And Vishnu himself, who is worshipped by all the worlds, who is born as the son of Devaki through Vasudeva, as Krishna, for the benefit of the world, he is birthless and deathless, the creator of the universe and the Lord of all. He is the invisible cause of all things. He knows no deterioration. He is the all-pervasive Atman and the center around which all things move. He is present in all things. He is the syllable Om in the Veda, which is praised repeatedly in the Brahmana texts as being the essence of all the Vedas. He is infinite and cannot be moved by anything except his own independent will. Thus that being who is the universe itself, without beginning, birth or decay, was born for the sustenance of dharma. And so that's kind of the context, the theological context of those stories. It tells the story of Krishna and Rama, who's seen to be an avatar of Vishnu. Vishnu is identified with Brahman and with the Atman of the Upanishads, and therefore is the source of everything. Now, if you bring that into the picture, a very sort of theistic system, there's something else that changes in the religious orientation and religious practice, and that if you have a deity that controls everything, and that, you know, is the origin of everything and so on, and that is a personal deity, you have an element of grace that comes in, and with sort of the response to grace in the Hindu context would be a notion of bhakti, of devotion. The notions of grace we find already in the Upanishads, in the theistic Upanishads, like the Mundaka, like the Katha, like the Shvetashvatara. You get an emphasis on grace where you get passages that state you cannot know the self, you cannot know Brahman unless the self or Brahman chooses to reveal himself to you. And so those later Upanishads put a lot of emphasis on that. And it's there that you see the Upanishadic meditations on the self and on Brahman kind of take a devotional sort of attitude, there's sort of a devotional attitude that becomes mixed in that. And indeed, the earliest occurrence of the word bhakti we have is in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, and the very final verse mentions the word bhakti. But you can see sort of the concept, even though the term is not used very widely in the Upanishad, in some of those other theistic Upanishads, surfacing in various ways. And so bhakti becomes an alternative to ritual performance and to meditational sort of practices that are taught in the Upanishads in these texts. Bhakti as a personal relationship with the divine, a personal relationship with Vishnu in this case, is a means and sort of a loving relationship, developing love for that deity and acting out of love for that deity, is a means to salvation and is a means to fulfill dharma. We won't talk a lot about bhakti today. In next class, when we look at the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita as a part of the Mahabharata, we'll talk more about the role of bhakti there. But that's kind of in the background of a lot of these, of both these texts. So keep that in mind. Now, Mahabharata and Ramayana, when were they written? Who wrote them? Traditionally, the Ramayana is said to be the work of a sage called Valmiki. The Mahabharata is said to be the work of Vyasa, Vyasa is literally, his name means Vyasa, the one who sets apart. He's traditionally credited with the division of the one Veda into the four Vedas, into four Samhitas, the collections that we have. What you find in texts like the Mahabharata and in the Puranas is the story that in the beginning of creation there was only one Veda, and at the beginning of the Kali Yuga, which is the current age we live in, where things kind of deteriorate and people are not as pious and not as smart and intelligent, Vyasa, out of compassion, took the one Veda, divided it into four, and made it easier to memorize those texts. So that's sort of how he's traditionally seen, but he's also seen as the author of this text of the Mahabharata, as we've seen the Mahabharata says this is the Veda of Vyasa, and this is the Veda that Vyasa wrote. There's a lot of debate among scholars of these texts, whether these texts were actually written by a single individual or whether they were composed over a period of time with more and more added to it. The Ramayana, it's still a substantial text, but there's a greater unity of narrative and coherence to the text. Generally, a lot of Ramayana scholars would argue that it is written by a single person. Some argue that the first and the last book of the Mahabharata, of the Ramayana, are later editions, and it's in the first and the last book that you get a lot of emphasis on the avatarhood of Ram, and where they would argue that the story arose as just a story of a certain king, and then later he became deified. The two sort of main Ramayana scholars, the Goldmans, they have argued recently that we should see the Ramayana as the work of a single individual, and that the first and the last book, and particularly the last book, are very integral to the story. That if you knock off the last book, the story doesn't quite work in some ways. But anyway, that's a debate. The Mahabharata is, as I mentioned, is this enormously lengthy work. That has a lot of subplots in it and a lot of lengthy digressions on dharma and on asceticism, on ritual action, on the nature of Brahman and so on. It's very encyclopedic in nature, although the main story that's told is the story of the, as we'll see in a moment, of the Bharatas, of this dynasty of the Bharatas. I think most scholars would argue it's a composite text that's been compiled over a period of time. Alf Hiltabeitel, who's one of the one of the giants in Mahabharata studies, he's very firmly of the opinion that it's a single author, or as others have argued, that it's at least a group of authors working together who composed the text in sort of a specific period. Those scholars who argue that it was a gradual development and a lot of authors adding to this, they would date the Mahabharata somewhere between the 2nd century BC to the 2nd century AD, so that's 400 years of the composition of the Mahabharata. And those who argue to the single author would place it somewhere in that period as well, but that it doesn't take that long to develop. Anyway, whatever position you want to take, it's complicated. Now, the Ramayana is a story of Ram, as I said. And Ram, he's the, I don't know if you know the story, if you're familiar with the story, but he is basically the crown prince of the kingdom of Ayodhya, which is in northern India. Due to some plots at the court, he gets banished from the kingdom before he can be crowned king. He leaves the kingdom very obediently with his wife and his brother. Lives in exile in the forest. While they're in exile in the forest, Sita, Rama's wife, gets kidnapped by the king from Lanka, which is often identified with Sri Lanka in South India, in the sort of southern subcontinent. He kidnaps Sita. He's the example of the adharmic king, the king who cannot control his senses, the king who's obsessed with him, with his own well-being rather than the well-being of his kingdom. He kidnaps Sita. Rama and Lakshmana and his brother, they start a quest looking for Sita. They don't know exactly what happened. On their travels, they meet an army of they meet the monkeys. There's a monkey society. The monkeys become their allies, chief of which, or sort of most, not chief, but the most popular among which is Hanuman. And with the army of monkeys, because Ram is in exile, he doesn't have an army of his own, so he has to get the monkeys to fight for him. They besiege Lanka, defeat Ravana, and then Rama and Sita return to Ayodhya. Or then the banishment is lifted. They're crowned king and queen, and that's kind of where for most Hindus the story ends. The Ramayana doesn't end there, and the end of the Ramayana is that Ram, who's throughout the story portrayed as the ideal king, as the person who is concerned only with the well-being of those who are dependent on him, of his subjects, of the kingdom. When he returns to Ayodhya, he hears rumors that some of his subjects, some of the citizens, question whether Sita, when she was captured, when she was kidnapped by Ravana, whether she remained faithful to Ram. And in order to set the example of being the ideal king, Ram banishes Sita from his kingdom, or sends her to the ashram of a sage, to the residence of a sage, and rules with a golden image of Sita next to him. And it's kind of that's the part that Hindus generally don't like. And in older, most of the, most of the retellings of the Ramayana, that's the part that gets left out or retold in some ways. But it's an integral part of the story, because it's the story is about dharma. And what the Ramayana is trying to present is, this is what it means to be an ideal king. This is what it means to live fulfill the dharma of a king. And Rama throughout, he makes a lot of decisions that are sort of very principled and very dharmic, that make the reader uncomfortable, that kind of like, ooh, he's really pushing it here, you know, he's really taking it far. When he gets banished at the beginning of the story, it's a complex tale of what happens, but he could say, you know, I'm not going to do it. And he says, no, my father, even though his father doesn't want him to be banished, his father sort of is sort of caught in a plot to get him banished, and he said, "Well, my father told me to be banished, so I'm banished. I fulfill the words of, I uphold the word of my father." And so it's really the ideal that is presented there is of a king who doesn't care about his own well-being, but is only concerned with the well-being of the kingdom. Now, you don't get a lot of digressions on dharma in here. It's really the story is meant to teach you what the dharma of a king would be. It's a very beautiful story. Traditionally it's seen to be the Adi Kavya, the first poet, the first poem, and it's really it's a masterpiece of Sanskrit literature. That you know, there's a reason why the story is still popular after millennia. And it's still, you know, retold in India and commented upon. The Mahabharata, on the other hand, is as I mentioned, tells a story as well of kings and of rival dynasties, but also inserts a lot of discussions on dharma itself. The story in the Mahabharata is of it's an enormously complex story, but the basic story is basically there's two brothers who are sort of the sons of the king, two princes. The eldest is born blind, and the youngest becomes king, even though the eldest should be king, but because he's blind, he's not considered fit to be king. So he abdicates the throne to his younger brother. His younger brother ends up having five sons, who the Mahabharata claims are technically not his sons. They're not his biological sons, but they're the sons of five Vedic gods. So it's Indra, Vayu, Yama or Dharma, and the Ashwinis, which are two twins amongst the gods. And they take birth, it's a bit confusing. Sometimes they're said to take birth as the five sons. Sometimes the five sons are seen to be the sons of those gods. And so when their father dies, who was the king, naturally the sort of the throne would go to the eldest of those five sons, who is a person called Yudhishthira. But the blind prince, sort of who was supposed to be king, he has sons of his own, chief of which is a person called Duryodhana. And Duryodhana claims the throne, saying that, well, my father was supposed to be king, but he just couldn't be king because he was blind. So he seizes the throne, and again through some complex sort of plots, gets Yudhishthira and his brothers banished from the kingdom. They have to live in exile for 13 years. They live in the wilderness, in the forests, and so on for 13 years. There's an attempt to reconcile the two branches of the family and to come to a compromise, but that doesn't happen. Krishna is sort of the mediator between those two, and in the end it leads to a full-on war, which is really the bulk of the Mahabharata deals with the war. If you ever want to become sort of disgusted with war, read that section of the Mahabharata. You just get rivers of blood and mountains of chopped off arms and so on. It's really by the end of the text you're just like, oh, you know, who wants anything to do with war? And that's sort of one of the messages, actually, of the Mahabharata, as we will see. And we'll see a bit more about the narrative next week when we look at the Bhagavad Gita, which is a part of this. But that's sort of the basic story. And so here, just as Ravana is the adharmic king in the Ramayana, here Duryodhana is the adharmic king, in the sense that he is primarily concerned about himself. Yudhishthira is always concerned about the well-being of the kingdom, and Krishna, who descends to uphold dharma, takes the side of Yudhishthira and his brothers to get him on the throne for the betterment of the world, for the good of society. Now, the Mahabharata has a lot to say on dharma, but the recurring message in the Mahabharata is that dharma is really complicated. The Dharma Shastra, and it's sort of a critique on the Dharma Shastra's views. The Dharma Shastras basically say, well, here's what you need to do in certain situations and so on. These are the principles that you need to follow. And what the Mahabharata does is it tells this super complicated story, this lengthy story, basically to show that dharma is not something that can be easily grasped. It's not something that is set in stone, that this is what it means to be dharmic, and then you can apply that to any situation. But one of the recurring messages of the Mahabharata is that dharma is subtle, is hard to understand. Even the wise are confused about dharma, and it always has to be seen in context. The most famous story, which you have on the handout, that illustrates this, is a story that Krishna tells to Yudhishthira, to Yudhishthira and Arjuna and his brother, where the background is interesting. It's that the war is going on. Arjuna is the greatest warrior on the battlefield, and the opposing army that day decides to basically get him trapped somewhere so that he cannot fight and so that the other side of the army can wipe out a part of the opposing army. And so Arjuna is sort of trapped on one side. Yudhishthira, he's fighting, he's humiliated, he's pretty much defeated, he has to retreat. He comes back to the camp at night. He tells Arjuna, he says, where were you? You know, what good are you in this fight? And they get into a fight amongst brothers. And at some point, Yudhishthira says, he's like, who are you with your stupid bow? And he, you know, Arjuna is known for being an archer, and he has a bow called Gandiva. And Arjuna had taken a vow that whoever insulted his bow will be killed on the spot. And so there he's in this dilemma. I have to kill my brother because he insulted my bow, and my word is my vow. That's sort of one of the themes in the Mahabharata as well, that if a Kshatriya, if he says something, he cannot take it back. And so he's kind of torn, you know, killing your brother is an adharmic act, but at the same time not maintaining your vow is adharmic as well. And Krishna tells them a story to sort of say, well, dharma is really tricky, you know, you can't sort of understand it so easily. And he tells the story of a Brahmin called Kaushika. And Kaushika is a very proper Brahmin. He's very truthful, which is one of the main virtues of a Brahmin. And one day there's this group of people that rush into his village and that come to him and they say, oh, we need shelter, we need to be able to hide somewhere, where can we go? And he says, oh, just over there's some caves, you know, or in the forest, you know, go there and you'll hide there. And immediately after them, shortly after them, there's a group of thieves or robbers or dacoits that sort of come in, and they're asking Kaushika, he said, do you know where those people went that passed through here? He said, oh yeah, they went there in the forest. And so they go and they kill those people. Kaushika dies. He meets Yama, who's the personification of dharma, the god of dharma. And he gets punished for breaking dharma. And he says, but how did I break dharma? I was truthful. And Yama says, no, you know, dharma is subtle. You cannot apply this in all situations. You have to find, see what is appropriate to that time and that place. And so that's kind of one of the themes that repeatedly comes in, and it's kind of the Mahabharata, and this is what frustrates some readers, doesn't give clear answers on this thing. And it's particularly when you think of the dharma of Kshatriyas, it sort of presents at least three different models for what it means to be a king. One is the model of Duryodhana, who, although he's selfish, and although in some cases he does sort of break with proper etiquette, at the end of the text he's praised as a dharmic king as well, just as Yudhishthira is, and he attains heaven just as Yudhishthira does. Yudhishthira is the opposite of of that. And Yudhishthira is a king who, a kshatriya who's really embodied a lot of Brahminical values. He doesn't want to take revenge. He abhors killing. There's a very famous passage which you have in the handout where he says the dharma of kshatriyas is the dharma of dogs. It's just, you know, one dog, you know, dog eat dog. That's sort of the idea. He says, you know, it's not something that's proper to follow. His teaching is teachings of non-violence, which is a main message of the Mahabharata as a whole, ahimsa, non-violence, is the highest dharma, is the you know, whatever you choose to do in a particular situation, it has to be, if it can be non-violent, it should be non-violent. And so that's kind of the total opposite of Duryodhana. Duryodhana doesn't mind going to war. Yudhishthira tries every possible way to avoid going to war. Gets criticized for his wife by his wife for that, for being a wimp. But sort of just takes it. And then the third one you have is the third model of kshatriyas that you have is Yudhishthira's brother Bhima. And Bhima is a fierce warrior, super impetuous, he, whenever any of his family is insulted or any of his subjects is insulted, he just wants to, you know, literally smash them to pieces. That's sort of his, it's sort of instant justice. And you get these scenes where in the Mahabharata where great injustice is done, and you get Yudhishthira, who's sort of the leader of his brothers, who kind of goes like, well, we should be forgiving, we should be tolerant, we should be, you know, we should not seek revenge. And as the reader, you know, some of these situations are really tricky, and you're kind of, you know, you want to see something happening, and the other characters in the Mahabharata criticize Yudhishthira for that and say, you know, this is not the time for this, you know, their justice needs to be done. And it's Bhima who then always steps forward and says, yes, let's do this, let's kill them all, and let's you know, his sort of attempt to use, it's basically for him, for Bhima, violence has a place in the sense of punishment is proper. If you're a king, you have to maintain order and law and dharma by punishing those who break it. Yudhishthira is sort of the opposite and says, no, non-violence in all situations as far as possible. That's the norm. And that's kind of the things the Mahabharata brings forward. And it doesn't answer, generally you do get the sense that sort of Yudhishthira is the main ideal that is presented. But Mahabharata is very clear that both Duryodhana and Bhima are equally proper in their execution of Kshatriya Dharma. It sort of leaves that open. The last thing that I want to mention, and this will lead to next week, is that the other thing that you see in the Mahabharata and the discussion of dharma is the notion of moksha dharma, of dharma leading to moksha, to liberation, which we've seen is not really there in the same way in the dharma shastras, where the, you know, as we've seen, dharma comes to replace Ritta, and it's about the main it's focused on this world. In the Mahabharata, and in particularly in the Bhagavad Gita, and those 18 chapters in the middle of the text, that becomes sort of reoriented to moksha, to liberation, and sort of dharma and the ascetic ideals that we've seen in the context of the Upanishads and a little bit in the Dharma Shastras last week, those two become fused and sort of seen as compatible with each other and being able to lead to liberation. But we'll see more about that next week. So just remember, Ramayana, Mahabharata, the main thing, they're both texts dealing with dharma, particularly the dharma of kshatriyas. They both are stories of avatars, of Vishnu. And because of that, there's a very strong theism, particularly in the Mahabharata, that comes in. And notions of bhakti, we'll see more next week, but that comes in. Particularly the Mahabharata and the Puranas that we'll see more about in 2 weeks, they place themselves on an equal footing with the Vedas as the fifth Veda. But by doing that, sort of, in some sense, see themselves as more important than those texts. So there you have it.